Aren't on the podcast today.
Yeah.
We've got that coming up.
Yeah, go ahead.
By the way, you can always watch the show back on Blaze TV.
That's what I'm doing right now.
If you happen to use the code BECKCHRISTMAS, you're going to get $20 off, which is
an amazing
deal. And you will be able to get all the shows from The Blaze and also what was formerly CRTV. You're up to like what, 30 shows or something like that.
Thousands of hours of information and entertainment that you just don't want to miss.
It's the best collection of conservative talent and shows ever produced, probably. And you can get it for as low as like $5 a month. So do it. BlazeTV.com/Beck. The code is BECKCHRISTMAS. In fact, one of the shows that you can get on the Blaze TV is Ally Stuckey. She's on. Allie is on Blaze now, and you'll be able to get her show as part of the package. And she was joined us today with a great appearance and talking about, you know, principles and how to live your life and how to look at issues.
And we also spent some time today talking about, you know, stopping the noise just a bit and noticing how good things really are. And if we didn't have the leadership that we have globally, would we be at each other's throats? I'm going to tell you a story today of the silence of Christmas morning in history and what we can learn. Also, how the world is becoming a much better place and somebody that maybe you can help out. Lance Robinson, a guy who found out his four-year-old has stage 4 cancer and isn't asking for anything except prayers. Prayers for Davis. All coming up on today's podcast.
You're listening to the best of the Glenn Beck program.
It's Tuesday, December 18th.
Glenn Beck.
Think of how connected we are. A friend wrote to me and said, I have a friend who started this for a friend. Could you just look into it? I went online and I saw this cute little four-year-old. Do you have Jingle Bells? Here he is singing Jingle Bells. Okay, this is a kid, in case you're not watching on Blaze TV, this is a kid who is singing Jingle Bells. And he's in the doctor's office. He has stage 4 cancer. He doesn't know that. But his parents, their whole life has changed. And so I mentioned it last hour. And I mean, this audience is always amazing. And so many of you reached out to PrayForDavis.com, PrayForDavis.com. And we actually have his dad on the phone with us now. Hi, Dad. How are you?
Hey, Glenn. How are you doing?
I'm good. I am pleased to talk to you. Lance Robinson is Dad's name. He is the father of the 4-year-old cancer patient named Davis. How is Davis, first of all?
You know, all things considered, he's doing pretty well. He's still the... Most days, he's still the happy, you know, joyous little boy that he's been all along. So we've been very blessed and thankful that, you know, he's responding well to chemo treatments in terms of side effects so far.
We have somebody in our office that is going through chemo now, and it's just brutal on an adult. How are you explaining this to him?
You know, it's actually really hard to explain because he doesn't understand. And other than the fact that when we originally went in, he was having pain in his abdomen, now that pain's gone. So when we have to explain, like, hey, Davis, we're going to the doctor today for a chemo treatment, he hates it. I mean, he really just, he gets so fearful and anxious about it. And all we can say is, like, buddy, it's to help you. And he keeps saying, but Daddy, I'm better. I feel better, you know, but we just know that we have to go through this treatment plan.
So he has stage 4, and it was in a tumor that they found because he had pain. They thought it was a appendicitis, but a good lab tech spotted this tumor. But it spread in his body. What are the, I don't mean to, but what is his prognosis?
You know, it's hard because they don't really talk about prognosis with the children. Generally, in children, because of how resilient they are, there's definitely a higher percentage rate that survive cancer at every measure, by a year, by 2 years, by 5 years, or whatever. So the best that I can say is that, you know, with rhabdomyosarcoma, which is what he has, they're kind of thinking it's like a 60 to 70% chance, I think, right now that he could make it through this and live for a long time. It's harder because, and this is crazy, but of these cases, they call it RMS, rhabdomyosarcoma. But of these cases, he's only the ninth kid ever on record that had his origin tumor start in his belly button like his. So that's kind of throwing them for a loop. But, it's you know, for us, for my wife and I, Amanda and I, we're just trying to take it a day at a time and honestly just, you know, continue to pray that God would heal him and that he wouldn't have symptoms from the chemo and everything. But right now that's the best I can say, 60 to 70% chance that he could, you know, at least survive this from this original stent of cancer.
Davis has an older daughter. What's her name?
His sister is, her name's
or
Lily.
Or daughter, she's sorry, eight. Sister. She's eight.
That's okay. Lily.
Lily?
Sorry.
How is she, how is she and how's mom holding up?
You know, Lily is, I just love her so much. She's an amazing little girl and she's doing good, but she does what I do, which is she internalizes a lot of things and she tries to take care of her mom, which is just unbelievable to see. You'll see Amanda get upset about something or, you know, in the hospital or whatever. And I'll watch Lily go over and take care of her, try to cheer her up. So for her, you know, it's going to be really hard for a long time because even though we are trying to be as intentional as we can with her, you know, all the attention right now is on her little brother. And I think that's a hard thing because she cares for him and she knows what's going on and she can understand a lot better about it. But at the same time, she's missing out on a lot of things because we can't go places. We can't, you know, we're missing out on church sometimes because we can't take Davis there. So I think it's just a hard road for her, especially like from a psychological standpoint.
Well, I know that you've only asked for prayers, but your friend on your website has put up a place to donate because you guys are taking a massive financial hit. Mom can no longer work and you run your own business and it's very difficult. If anybody wants to donate, you can go to prayfordavis.com. But I would ask the audience to please keep Lily in your prayers too. Lily is her name, right?
Yeah.
Please keep Lily in your prayers. Especially this time of year. I mean, here's this little girl who is just, you know, weathering a storm of her life as well. And it will change her forever. And hopefully it will change her and the whole family for the better. God's will be done. Lance, thank you so much for talking to us. Have a great Christmas.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet.
You too. Thank you.
You bet. PrayForDavis.com. Now, that is the good use of technology. When I first got into this, I couldn't have found out about this family. I couldn't have seen pictures. I couldn't have had a picture or a video or audio of this cute four-year-old little boy. I would have had a letter. Then I would have had to find the family, put them on the phone. But how could people just give money, stuff it into an envelope? Our life has been so greatly enhanced and our ability to help one another so greatly enhanced by the same technology that can be used to destroy. But that is the case with everything. We are either great creators or we are great destroyers. It all goes back to what my father said to me. We're the two most powerful words in any language, and that is, I am. I am angry. I am going to get vengeance. I am weak. I am pathetic. Or I am a healer. I am a helper. I am happy. I am full of abundance. I am going to share all that I have.
Glenn Beck.
So Ali Stuckey worked for us for I don't know how long, and then CRTV stole her mm-hmm. from us.
Stole her.
Others might say, rescued her from us. and then when this deal was going through for our merger, the one face that kept coming to me was Ali going, oh, dear God, no, please, no, no, please, no.
Don't send me back there.
Right. So I just wanted an honest, I mean, that's really what went through your head, wasn't it?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. I am very glad. I've heard so many good things about the potential of this merger, and all of them have come true so far. Yeah. And I think it's only going to get better and better.
Yeah.
So
it is. It's time that we all kind of come together and stand together and leave each other alone. And let everybody do their own thing. You have just been remarkable. Let's start with what happened yesterday. How did you, who were you tweeting this to, and what has it turned into? Because I read it and I thought, oh my gosh, this is great.
So my tweet yesterday was exactly what you said. If we are saying that young children or even teenagers are, that they have the capacity to consent to a sex change, to hormone blockers, to all of these things that we say are necessary for gender transformation at a young age, why don't they also have the capacity to consent to a relationship with an older person? Or like you posed, a young child, why not? What logically is actually stopping that? And of course, the leftist blue check marks came out in droves saying that this is a ridiculous connection, that this is the slippery slope fallacy. But of course, they couldn't actually answer the question. Right. They couldn't say why logically that is different. I knew that my mentions were going to go up in flames, but I think it's a reasonable question to ask, and I never got an answer to it.
Well, because you're just saying one is a really important decision. So if you have the capacity to make one really important decision, why wouldn't you have the capacity to make another important decision?
Because there is no other reason. We say consenting adults.
Right.
So if it's consent and you don't have to be an adult to make game-changing decisions, then what really, and I'm not saying this slippery slope, I'm saying let's just be consistent.
Exactly. And that's a really good point, is really when it comes to sexual morality for most progressives or most people on the left, the only lines of morality that are drawn are autonomy and consent. So I'm just saying, if those are the only lines of morality that are drawn when it comes to sexuality, what's stopping a child who apparently has autonomy and consent from exercising that autonomy and consent when it comes to having an older relationship? So the argument really is that maybe there are other lines of morality that we should draw outside of autonomy and consent. Maybe there are other things that we should consider.
So who came after you yesterday?
Oh, I don't even know who they are. Okay. Well, I knew when Ben Shapiro retweeted me that they were going to come out. It kind of flew under the radar for a little bit until the power of Ben Shapiro came.
So
it's a blessing and a curse on that one. Because every once in a while, he'll retweet something that I do. And then it's just like, I've got my entire mentions for the next 2 days is just nonstop.
Ben haters are intense.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. And he is, what's great about Ben is he can take you apart logically, and you don't even know it. You're all of a sudden your skeleton standing with no meat on your frame, and you're like, what just happened to me? I don't even know what just happened to me. You are really focused, and I love this, you are really focused on spiritual things and things of deep meaning, which people will say millennials don't connect with. I don't believe that, and I know you don't believe that.
Right. Well, I think that millennials are like any other group of human beings, and that we are on the search for truth. I think that we just look in the wrong places typically. So millennials are the least religious and the most politically progressive generation in America's history. And I don't think, and I know that correlation doesn't prove causation, but I don't think it's a coincidence that we're also the least satisfied or the least happy. We're the most suicidal. We're the most addicted, the most medicated. There's something that religion or the lack of religion has left within us, and we're still searching for something. We're still searching for some kind of purpose, just like any other generation.
So I am, I'm obviously not in your generation, and I feel the same way, though.
Says anyone about, with eyes. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. The religion is, so much of it is bogus. And while ritual is important for many reasons, it's more, much more subtle. And you can go to church and you're not hearing anything that is actually relating to anything that is helping me deal or understand today. And so how do you find meaning in religion? Is it that they're looking? I mean, I think they're rejecting religion because there's not a lot there.
Yeah, maybe so. But I'm not shy about what religion and what faith I think will ultimately fulfill you. And that's the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I'm not going to shy away from that and just say, you know, religion in general, faith in general, that's going to help you. I don't believe that. If I did, then I wouldn't be a Christian. It would be a lot easier for me not to have to take up my cross, deny myself and follow Christ and just say, yeah, religion is great. Go along with these rituals. They'll make you feel better. I don't believe that. I believe that Jesus is what fulfills you. That doesn't mean that we're going to find temporal happiness every single day simply because we are Christians, but that Jesus satisfies that void that's in your soul. And that's the audience that I'm speaking to. And there are a lot of non-Christians that follow me and listen to my audience, but the niche that I've kind of carved out are A, people that are seeking truth and they haven't really figured it out yet, and B, young Christians that want to hear their faith logically discussed, logically debated, logically talked about within the realm of culture and politics. And so I'm not shy about which faith I think satisfies. I don't think it's religion in general. I think it's Jesus.
I would say that religion in general has been one of the problems.
When you keep saying that, do you mean like the people who are doing it or people who are misusing it for other purposes?
Gandhi said it great. I love this Jesus. I just don't like his followers. Okay? And so many of us are not living it. Right. And yet we are the first to point to someone else and say, look at their flaws.
Totally.
And those people are going to hell because they don't do X, Y, or Z. Well, neither are you, Jack. Neither are you.
Yeah.
And we are right now, in the last few years, I have been blown away by the number of people who are devout Christians who, to me, deny their faith every time they say, yeah, Glenn, you know, peace and all of that stuff, that will, you know, that's fine, but that's not going to work. Really? Because that's what Jesus said to do.
Right.
And they deny the power of the actual gospel. If we are actually living it and not so busy going, oh, you got to get baptized in the name of Jesus, but just living it, just actually loving people. And that's hard to do.
And I think people have a really hard time. I have a hard time with this. The balance between fighting for what is right in a way that is effective and also being a peacemaker. Is it possible to fight for truth? Truth is inherently divisive, and also be a peacemaker.
Jesus.
Also be. Exactly. He did.
He did. He never denied it, and he was never weak.
Yes.
He was never weak.
And you're exactly right. And I think it's difficult for people to follow that example. I would say the problem is not religion, it's sin. That's the problem that's always been.
Okay, back in just a second with Allie Stuckey. So Allie, we left it at sin. What do you mean? Define sin.
Well, everything that you just described, which I think can probably be encapsulated by the word hypocrisy, that's sin. That's not necessarily the fault of Christianity or the fault of religion. It's the fault of imperfect people who are hypocrites. And I do think people have misused religion to make themselves feel self-righteous, mm-hmm. to stand on our pedestal and say, you're wrong, but I'm good because I'm a Christian or I'm whatever. And I do think that's wrong, but that's not a problem of religion. That's just a problem of sinful people.
Yes. Except I think our religion, our houses of worship, our systems right. are developed by men. The yes. gospel is his.
Right. Right.
The system, when I say religion, I mean the system of administering that. It's so warped and we're yelling at each other because you don't go to my church and I don't go to your church and I'm better than you because of that. It's like, I don't remember Jesus saying any of that stuff. He said, yeah. do these things. And we're falling down on those things.
Yeah. And I would totally agree with you on that. Where we might disagree, and something that I talk about on my podcast a lot, is the importance of good theology. The importance of understanding your Bible, understanding the context of scripture, and believing the right thing. Some people say, no. It's not about that. Jesus didn't talk about theology. It's just about your personal relationship with Christ. But I would posit that you can't have a personal relationship with God until you know God accurately.
So we are going through this. I'm going through this with my teenagers right now. You have to find God on your own. Has to be a personal relationship. But once you find God, you have to ask yourself, is any of this stuff true? Did he rise from the dead? Because if he didn't, okay, how are you going to find the sense of peace and forgiveness? If he didn't, why are you doing this, this, and this?
If he didn't, none of it matters.
None of it matters. It's just a good book with some really good safety tips in it. And that's entirely different than God. Mm-hmm. So what does it mean when you find God? So I mm-hmm. think we're kind of on the same page.
I wanted to ask you, Allie, I was fascinated by something that happened to you over the past year, which was a controversy with one of our favorite people, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh,
did
that's right.
an interview, a quote-unquote interview
I
with
saw
her.
It. It was an interview. I saw it with my own
eyes.
Real. It was real.
It was real.
She was there.
I saw you and I saw her and you were talking.
What was weird is the questions were different from, did you see the interview on NPR? Because it was totally, she answered the same way.
It looked the same way.
It was crazy.
And you obviously edited yourself in and made a really funny piece with you interviewing Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I was fascinated by the way that people reacted, in which they tried to make it seem as if you were trying to mislead people, that the interview was real. First of all, what was that like going through? And secondly, does that, because the indication I got is they were scared of you. The fact that they would do that and try to, it was such a ridiculous angle of attack, and try to, you know, to squash you in that moment and say something that was obviously a parody was real. I don't know. That indicates that they were intimidated by that whole thing.
Well, first of all, I was not anticipating this kind of blowback. I thought, okay, this will be a funny video. People will like it, but it's not going to cause controversy. Yeah. When I woke up the next day and had emails from BuzzFeed and the Washington Post asking me, and this is the thing that I also learned. We all know that there are biased journalists out there, but what I realized in the questions that they were asking me, so targeted towards the conclusion that they had already drawn, is that, oh, so this is how it works. They start with a foregone conclusion and they back up from there, and they'll fill in the facts that they want to fill in. What really just struck me, which I guess, again, we already knew, was the stunning arrogance of these leftist journalists who say, no, readers, you probably didn't know that this was fake. But because we are so cunning, because we journalists are so smart, let us break this down for you. This was a fake interview. She was trying to mislead you. I'm like, good job, y'all are so clever. That's what amazed me about it.
There's a subtle undertow, I think, of the whole Russia situation that is very connected to that. In that they keep bringing up the Russia situation with the memes and the, you know, the bots and everything promoting Trump as it approached the election. But the undercurrent of that is, everyone knows that you're an absolute moron if you voted because of a meme.
Right.
And in their view of America, everyone is just dumb enough to be fooled to vote for Donald Trump because of a meme. Now, I don't know anyone who's dumb enough to vote because of a meme. But that's like that. It's like, did you get the sense that they were trying to, A, talk down to people, but B, do you get the sense that they actually believed it? Do you think that they had a question as to whether you were trying to pull this off as a real interview or not.
I don't know. I think it's possible that they really are just so hypersensitive to being made fun of or anything that they find important, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez being trivialized, that maybe they convinced themselves that it was real. But I thought that they were just playing me. I thought that everyone knew it was a joke, yeah, but they were trying to get it taken down because they didn't like it. They don't like to be made fun of. Conservatives are the only ones that are allowed to be made fun of. I didn't play by the rules. And so this is the tactic that we are going to employ to try to destroy you. And it was in that time that I learned that you do not apologize when you're not wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I didn't.
Yeah. No, that
it's
was
a, it's a remarkable thing. Anybody can tell you how dishonest, and people always say, oh, I know. But when you're actually sitting in the chair.
Right.
And they're talking to you.
Right.
And it's different off the air or different prior to the interview. And then they start doing it and you're like, oh my God, it's stunning,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. And I know you've experienced that so many times, but reading some things in the Washington Post that, well, Ali Stuckey has never made a parody video before. This is the first we've seen. I'm like, okay, so you're just making things up now. It really is. A crazy experience.
Okay. What do you think is the fascination with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? I've seen the media tossing this one around. My kind of theory I landed on, I think the Republicans in general like to elevate her because the fact that, you know, here's an admitted socialist who doesn't seem to know a lot about the things that she's talking about.
Yeah.
If that's going to be the face of the opposition, good for us.
Yeah.
What do you think is the reason? What's the fascination with her?
I think so. I think the left has glorified her because she is somewhat of a renegade. She is very relatable. I'll give her that. She uses social media well.
Yeah.
She says things that I'm like, I totally get what you're saying when she talks about personal things. So I understand that. And a student asked me, are you afraid that this is going to now encourage more socialists to run for office and possibly win? I said, no, I am afraid that it's going to encourage more ignorant people to run for office. And win. That's what I'm afraid of. I think that's the precedent that she's setting, and that's why many people like me are so worried about it.
I love it. Allie, thank you so much
thank
for
you.
Coming in.
Glenn Beck.
The best of the Glenn Beck program.
Hi, it's Glenn. If you're a subscriber to the podcast, can you do us a favor and rate us on iTunes? If you're not a subscriber, become one today and listen on your own time. You can subscribe on iTunes. Thanks.